Good evening. It's wonderful to be with you tonight, and thank you for coming, taking the time. I thought this was a nice day. Compared to other experiences. It's really wonderful to be with you and to share my story with you and some of the work that we are doing. And then we'll have a discussion together. Questions, comments, any feedback that you have. So my name is Sam Allen, and I'm the director of an organization called Holy Land Trust in Bethlehem, an organization that was established almost 20 years ago, in 1998. And I want to start, before I talk about the work that we are doing, I want to share a little bit of my background and my history and my story. Because a lot of what I do now has a lot to do with the upbringing that I had as a Palestinian living in the occupied territories. And I always, in the past, when I shared my story, I would jokingly say that Palestinians and Israelis, despite the conflict that we live in, when we share our story, we start with the same opening line. And the opening line that we have in common is in 1948. 1948, many of us know what happened. There was a war that led to the war that happened after Israel announced itself as a state. So the establishment of the state of Israel happened. So that time was a celebration for the Jewish people. And 1948 was what we as Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, the catastrophe that led to a lot of pain and suffering for us. And so we have the same opening line, but then we have completely distinct stories that come out of that opening line. More recently, I began to realize that when I start by 1948, by stating that date, it for me feeds into another common narrative about this land, which is the narrative that says this land, the Holy Land, blood, Palestine, Israel, is a land that has always experienced war and conflict. It is historic. It goes back for centuries. Some people even say it goes back for millennia. And that since the beginning of time, this land is a land that is suffering and pain, and the people who live in this land, as if every day we wake up to fight each other, to kill each other. And 1948 is just another one of those many episodes of conflict and war that exists in this land, in this one ongoing conflict. Even some people refer to Ishmael and Isaac, you know, the sons of Abraham, as if we are the offsprings of these two children, these two brothers, and we have continued the fight that existed between them. Somehow we forget that actually those two brothers reconciled on the grave of their father when they buried him. They came together to bury their father. So that their conflict ended, and somehow there was this genetic mutation that happened to their kids that continued this conflict. And so more recently I shifted my opening line. I start from a different opening line. And the opening line I start with is before 1948. What was life like in this land before 1948 happened? And specifically, I refer to my family and where my family lived and where my father was born and grew up, which was a neighborhood in Jerusalem known as Musrara. And this neighborhood was a neighborhood that was actually evenly divided between Jews, Christians, and Muslims. They lived together as good neighbors. They honored each other. They respected each other. They celebrated with each other. And I'm not claiming that this was a utopian land. There was many conflicts that existed in this land, but I would say never to the point that we live in now. And what's very interesting in this neighborhood, like many other communities, is that the people that lived there and got along with each other were not sort of your leftist, progressive, liberal people who said religion is the problem, let's not deal with it and just find a way to get along with each other. Let's find the least common denominator between us and common ground and work it out. No, these were very religious,
very orthodox, what we would call very conservative, and they still got along with each other. And so for me, one of the questions that I ask myself is what happened? What happened to that reality that shifted that way of life, that understanding that we all live in this land to where we are now, where people are claiming exclusivity to this land, and that nobody else has the right to this land, and it's only for us and nobody else, and we are fighting in this terrible war that we live in. 1948 did happen, and as a family, we suffered from the war. My grandfather was killed in the war. He was killed by a sniper in this war, and when the Jewish forces came and took over the neighborhood, they demanded that all the non-Jewish families, the Christians and the Muslims, leave. And so my grandmother, who had 7 children, the oldest was 12 and the youngest was 2, left their home, became part of the Palestinian refugee population. You may have heard about the Palestinian refugees. Over 800,000 Palestinians left their homes and towns and communities and villages at that time and were spread in different areas. My grandmother and her family went from Jerusalem, in a place not too far away, which is Bethlehem, because she had a brother that was living there. And the idea was this will be temporary until the war ends and then she will go back to her home. That was 70 years ago, and that return has not happened for us. And so the family experienced tremendous tragedy. My grandmother actually says, as a family, we lost everything. She lost her husband, which is the man that she loved, the father of her children. She lost her home, her property. She lost her job. She lost all her possessions, everything that she owned. She actually says she lost her future. Any future that she had dreamed for her family was destroyed in 1948. But for me, my grandmother is the reason why I do the work that I do now. Because she was a woman that always insisted, as a family, despite everything that we have lost, that as a family, we will never seek revenge and retaliation for what happened to us. That we will not gain anything back if we attack them, if we make them pay, if we think that we're making them pay for what they did to us. And another thing that she always insisted on, that as a family, we will also proactively seek peace and reconciliation with those who have done this to us. And so we will not remain silent in the face of violence and injustice that we continue to face. For her, she actually defined justice as this process. And then I would say even today I still struggle with it, because if I ask you to define justice, many would say justice means getting back what we lost. Justice means making them pay for what they did to us. Justice may mean retaliation for you. But for her, she defined justice as the process of peacemaking and reconciling with those who commit injustice. So it wasn't even an end goal for her. Justice was the process to reach real peace with our enemies, with those who are violent. And as I said, even till this day with all my work, I continue to struggle with her definition. But that, for me, is the seed that this woman planted in the family many, many years ago. And for us, that presence of this woman has been a blessing for all the work that we do. Her 7 children grew up, and many of them have become very strong peace activists in the region itself. But for me, my story is that I was actually born in the U.S. My father, as I said, is from Jerusalem, and my mother is from Gaza, from the Gaza Strip. And they were both living in the U.S. When I was born. My father was teaching in an inner city school in the middle of the United States in Kansas City when I was born. And when I was 6 months old, my father received a call from the Mennonite church, and they were offering him a job to go back to Bethlehem to run a local orphanage that they had started a few years back. And my father says it took him 6 seconds to say yes. that immediately he packed his wife and his son, me, and we flew to Bethlehem, where for many years he was principal of this orphanage. And my father grew up as an orphan, living in an orphanage, living in very difficult circumstances in this orphanage, and he felt that this was an opportunity for him to give back to a new generation of Palestinian orphans what he had lost growing up as an orphan child. And this new generation was the generation that was created after the 1967 war. And so I grew up in this orphanage. My younger brother and sister were born after me, and we grew up treated as equal with the children of this orphanage, living with them, living in the same orphanage, and really connecting with them and being blessed by my parents for the work that they did. At the same time, this is after 1967, so I grew up living in what we as Palestinians define as the Israeli military occupation. One thing that happened in 1967, as maybe all of us know, is Israel actually won the war. And they won the war in 6 days. So in 6 days, Israel was able to take full control over the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. And sometimes I wonder and think if Israel, after that, completely annexed all of this territory that they won and made it all part of the state of Israel, what would my life be like? I probably would be coming to New Zealand for vacation, not to give speaking tours about the conflict and the situation there. Yes, maybe the situation would be in conflict, but not the conflict that exists for us now. And so Israel did not annex the territory, even though they won it. It became all of under their control. Israel set up a different set of rules and regulations in these territories that were under the Israeli military control. So the Israeli military was responsible and controlling our lives, while Israelis living in Israel were under the civil law, the Israeli parliament, the Knesset legal system, and we were under the military legal system. That means all our rights as Palestinians, all our aspirations were controlled and even, I would say, suppressed by the Israeli military. Our basic freedoms that existed for the Israelis on the Israeli side did not exist for us on the Palestinian side. That exists in any nation in the world. Freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, freedom to self-determination, freedom to elect your representatives, freedom of the press. All of these basic freedoms did not exist for us. What existed for us was hundreds of military commands that literally controlled every single aspect of our life. And these military commands, again, issued by the Israeli military, we didn't have a vote on them to say we like them or we don't like them. This was the Israeli military. And a big part of these commands were issued to try to prevent us as Palestinians from expressing our national aspirations, from expressing what we felt was our right to self-determination, human rights violations that we were facing. People were put in prison for talking about these things. If you came and visited me during that time and I was sharing about Palestinian rights to freedom, to self-determination, and the Israeli military find out, I could be put in prison for saying these things. So it was a very suppressive system of control that we grew up in. In addition to the presence of the army, the Israeli army, another group of Israelis that were present that sometimes were even more violent than the army, these are what are known as settlers. And settlers were Israeli civilians, many of them coming from very strong ideological and religious convictions, who moved into the West Bank because for them they were moving into what they referred to as Judea and Samaria, the historic land of the Jewish people. But in coming into these lands, they were violating, first of all, international law, because it was considered illegal, and still considered illegal, to move civilians into disputed or occupied territories. And they were also very violent towards us as Palestinians. As I said, sometimes even maybe more violent than the soldiers, the Israeli soldiers themselves. So I grew up in a situation where, in my growing up, in my narrative that I grew up in, my experiences, it was easy to hate those who were doing this to us. I saw the brutality of the soldiers towards us as Palestinians on a continuous basis. Even raiding the orphanage that my father or we lived in and grew up in, sometimes for absolutely no reason. Or maybe if the reason was a Palestinian throwing a stone at an army jeep, the whole army would come in from that area and raid the school and put us under curfew and detain and beat up other Palestinian children. So for me it was very challenging to, in a sense, bridge two narratives. A narrative of a reality that was filled with violence and hatred, and a narrative of a family that says, seek peace and reconciliation with them. How does it just cannot happen. As a child, I argued with my father, how dare you ask us to make peace with them, and look how we are treated, look what they're doing to us. They don't want to make peace. They're the strongest one. And again, this is just the stories and the narratives that I grew up in as a child. Things began to change for me when I was 12 years old, when an uncle of mine, who had been living in the US, came back, and he came back with this idea that as Palestinians, we can resist this occupation, we can seek freedom, we can seek self-determination, and we could do that through nonviolence. Studying Gandhi and the liberation movement in India, studying Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement in the US, my uncle came with this notion that nonviolence is a tool, is a means that we as Palestinians can use to achieve our goals. And I'm proud to say that my uncle did not introduce nonviolence to the Palestinians. Palestinians had engaged in nonviolence previously, but his idea was that instead of waiting for the Palestinian leadership to come and liberate us, because at that time Yasser Arafat and the PLO were outside of the land, and Palestinians had these dreams and aspirations that these freedom fighters are going to come and end this occupation and liberate us, we don't need to wait for them, we are the ones that are suffering, let us proactively engage in building a nonviolent movement. And so from the age of 12, I started participating with my uncle in this nonviolent work. One of the big things that happened for me in working with my uncle is my own stereotype of Israeli society broke when I met what are known as Israeli peace activists. Israelis who understood that the policies and the conduct of their government was wrong, and they wanted to engage with us, and not just sympathizing with us, not just feeling sorry for us, ready to stand with us as Palestinians in our struggle for liberation, especially our nonviolent struggle for liberation. As a child going into these demonstrations, many times I would be defended by Israeli activists from soldiers who were attacking us. They would stand in the middle between us and them and even get beat up, even get arrested, because they stood for what they believed was a real expression of peace and justice for both of us and them. And that was a big turning point in my life that opened my eyes to begin to understand that there is more to the other than just what I had learned or even what I had experienced until that point. A major turning point happened in my life, or in the family's life, in 1988. In 1987, so before 1988, Palestinians, in a sort of spontaneous manner, launched what was known as the Intifada. You probably heard this word before, Intifada, which means uprising or civil revolt, but the literal meaning of Intifada means to shake off. This is what you did today when you walked in the room from your winter coats and your umbrellas. The word Intifada means to shake off. And the idea for us was to shake off the occupation. This is what the word Intifada literally means, to shake it off. And again, the idea, we need to shake off this occupation that we are living under. And a lot of the actions and the activities of this Intifada were nonviolent in nature. I'm not going to say it was exclusively nonviolent. If you actually look into the history of nonviolence, around the world, there was never really an exclusive movement of nonviolence. Gandhi had people who opposed him using nonviolence. They felt that violence was the way to get rid of the British. Martin Luther King also had his Malcolm X, people who believe that there are more ways than nonviolence to get rid of white control and achieve liberty for the black community there. And so for us as Palestinians, this was also part of our movement. But at that time, many Palestinians took on nonviolence. And this was amazing. People working together, coming together, supporting each other. Israeli peace activists joining us in our demonstrations. And it included demonstrations and protests. But even more than this, because many people think nonviolence is just about demonstrating against, in the core of nonviolence and its teaching is not just demonstrating against, it is how do you create a situation where obedience and compliance to the systems and structures of power begin to dismantle. This is the core of nonviolence activism, where I no longer obey a system that is creating oppression. I no longer create a situation where I am exclusively benefiting from that system. I begin to create alternatives. And this is what was happening in the first Intifada. Let me give just a couple of examples to show you what I mean by this. So what we had in the first Intifada was an underground leadership. And this underground leadership, almost every week, would issue a leaflet. So we didn't have internet at that time, or WhatsApp, or any of these social media things. So these leaflets were printed and were distributed at night in the streets of our towns and cities. And these leaflets had in them like an itinerary of different activities that the underground leadership was asking us to do as part of the nonviolent struggle. And so, for example, one day they would say, today, like on Monday, is a strike day. A strike day, we were happy as children, because a strike day meant we didn't go to school. Everything was on strike. Shops, markets, schools, we stayed home on strike days. This is what the strike days were. They would say on Wednesday at 4:30, we want everybody to go on their roofs and with whatever instruments they have, if it's trumpets, if it's drums, if it's pots or pans or whistles or even clapping their hand, for half an hour to make as loud of a noise as they can. And that was it. And you think, well, what is nonviolent about that? You know, if you're not blowing a horn in somebody's ear, that's quite peaceful. The idea behind it wasn't, again, about this direct resistance. The idea behind it, like in any situation where there is a system that is creating oppression, that you begin to break obedience to that system and begin to create alternative leadership. So the challenge with occupation in such an activity was that there was an alternative leadership that these people were listening to, that these people were trusting. And this is what was the underground leadership. I'll give you my favorite example. You guys change your watches here from daylight time? Because you're like the first people to experience daytime. I don't even know what you change and not change. But how we change our times from summertime to wintertime, living under occupation, it was automatic. When the Israeli media, because we didn't have any media, when the Israeli media said, next Saturday we go to daylight saving time, next Saturday everybody changed their watch and we went to daylight saving time. And so what this underground leadership did, in I think one of the most creative nonviolent actions, was to say in one of the leaflets, let us change our time a week after Israel changes its time. So they changed their time this Saturday. We'll just hold on till the Saturday after, and then we'll change our time to summertime. And you look at this and say, again, a very simple action. What does it do? What effects does it have? But for me, and I remember this so well, I was 16 years old at that time, and for me what it did For me, it was the first thing we liberated, our time. We created something called Palestine time. We would go to school on Palestine time. They had our parents to go to work on Palestine time. And it was amazing. A simple act like this. And it was very challenging to the Israeli military that we were doing this. Even Israeli soldiers would be stopping people in the streets to check the times they had during this week and to demand that they have to go to the new time. This for me is what nonviolence is about. I always use the word empowerment when I use the word nonviolence. It's about empowering a community to say we refuse to obey, we refuse to comply by the structure that is creating oppression. And it could be personal or collective. And this is what we try to teach people. In 1988, my uncle was arrested by the Israeli government. And then for me, I want to be very clear when I'm speaking about military and government. It's not about the Israeli people, it's not about the Israeli society. It's about the structures that we were suffering from. We were not suffering from the Israeli people, but these structures of oppression that were created that we as Palestinians suffered from and in many situations continue to suffer from today. And so the Israeli government arrested my uncle, they put him on trial, and my uncle was labeled, it was the Shamir government at that time, and the government of Israel labeled my uncle as a threat to its national security. A nonviolent peace activist, who I think, in my opinion, had more Israeli friends than Palestinian friends, was seen as a threat to the national security of one of the greatest military nations in the region, if not even in the world itself, per capita. And a lot of people protested. A lot of Israeli peace activists protested, the rest of my uncle. A lot of people who were not even peace activists were very surprised by this act. And very specifically, I always mention a name of an Israeli professor. His name is Eddie Kaufman from Hebrew University, who wasn't involved in politics, who wasn't involved in nonviolence. But as an Israeli, he heard about the story of what was happening, and he just said, I cannot accept this happening in my name, that my government is doing this. And he went on hunger strike without even ever meeting my uncle. He went on hunger strike to demand the release of my uncle. When my uncle found out about it, they started corresponding with each other. And after that, the two have actually become very good friends until this day. At the end of the day, the Israeli government issued deportation orders. That means my uncle had to leave the country. He was physically kicked out from the country and was not allowed to return and to live in the land that his ancestors existed in for hundreds of years. And that was a big turning point in my life, that this nonviolent activist, the peace activist, was deported, was kicked out from the land because of his work at nonviolence. And for me, that was when I went too deep into asking the question, what is the power of nonviolence? Many people say that if the Palestinians do nonviolence, everything will be okay. Really? Will it be okay? Because nonviolence is about standing up and resisting and challenging the structures of power. Are we ready to challenge these structures of power? Are Israelis ready to have these structures of power challenged, really, to move forward? Nonviolence is not just about coming together and sitting around the circle and eating hummus and singing kumbaya. There is much more to it that is challenging. Are we ready to take these steps? And so for me, I began this journey to really begin to learn and understand what this nonviolence is all about. I ended up in the U.S., not the best country to educate about nonviolence, but that's where I ended up, where I did an undergraduate degree in political science and did a master's degree in international relations with a focus on peace and conflict resolution. And I came back a week after I graduated from college, when I finished my master's program. In 1996, I came back at that time not interested in nonviolence and not interested in resistance. I came back fully excited and celebrating what was happening on the ground, which was a peace process, known as the Oslo peace process. You may have heard about it. It was at a time when the Israeli leadership and the Palestinian leadership came together in secret negotiations in Oslo. That's why it's called the Oslo peace process. and announced in Washington, D.C., on the White House lawn, a peace process that they were going to work together to achieve peace in a framework known as the two-state solution. The two-state solution meant that Israel was going to hand over the territories that it had occupied in 1967, which is about 22% of the land, for the Palestinians to establish their state, and Israel will be recognized fully on the rest of the territories. 78% of the land would be recognized as Israel, and the 22% would be seen as Palestine. The two-state solution framework was presented to us as the only possible peace that can exist between the two peoples. And we came back celebrating this. Yeah, as Palestinians, we felt we got the short end of the stick, 22%, they get more, but it was fine. For the sake of peace, for the sake of ending the occupation, our leadership told us we will approve of this and move forward with it. Very quickly, I began to see what I call the cracks in this peace process. And it wasn't something that was unique, you know, some insight that I had. If we really read Israeli and Palestinian authors and writers who really understood the situation, we all would have said there is something wrong in this peace process. And I think the wrong that existed in the peace process exists on both sides of the equation. One big challenge that I felt was taking place during the negotiations was this issue of the settlements. So the Palestinians were promised land for peace. This is what the whole peace process was, land for peace. The problem that we were seeing was that big chunks of the land that were promised to Palestinians were being confiscated or taken over or used, even if they were public domain, used by the Israeli government to build these settlements, these major housing units, towns and villages, for Jewish Israeli settlers to move into. And so for me it was very strange. How can you be talking land for peace while at the same time you're taking land and moving settlers to this land, building these settlements, making it difficult, if not impossible, to negotiate the land for peace treaty in the future? And it wasn't just the building of these housing units, it was also a network of roads that was being created that connected these settlements together and connected the settlements into mainland Israel, like little islands connected back into the mainland that only Israelis can use, that were dividing even the West Bank even more than what it was before. And so for me it was just, what is the purpose of building these settlements when you're supposed to be, in a sense, evicting the previous settlements so that we can establish this two-state solution framework? That was one big challenge. A second big challenge was in understanding what peace means. What I started seeing and noticing was that in the peace process, Palestinians and Israelis actually met each other less than before the peace process began. There were more restrictions imposed during the years of the negotiations than before the negotiations began. As Palestinians, for example, for us to go to Jerusalem and to Israel, we now needed to have special permission by the Israeli military. And every Palestinian needed to have that permission. For Israelis to come into Palestinian-controlled areas, they needed to have permission by the Israeli military as well. And so it became much more difficult. And yes, I'm not denying the violence, I'm not even denying the terrorism that existed, but everybody suffered from the lack of connection and lack of ability to meet the other. Before the peace process began, for example, Israelis during Shabbat would come into Bethlehem and buy their groceries on Saturday from Bethlehem Market. Now it became difficult for them to do this. Israelis used to come and bring their cars to Palestinian mechanics. That for me was peace. You know, it's not, you know, having heads of NGOs meet in fancy hotels and play these negotiation games between them. It is about your average person that lost and was disconnected from being able to meet the other and to speak the language of the other. And so for me that was another challenge, that there was more separation happening than actually bringing people together. The third challenge that I saw was within the Palestinian society itself. The dream for us as Palestinians, when we were told that we are going to have our independent state, was that we are going to have, for the first time, the real expression of a real democracy in the Arab world. You know, many leaders in the Arab world claim democracy. And as I always say, they celebrate elections because they win by 95%. We actually say we have 5% opposition to us. And who knows what happens to that 5% when they find them. And so for us as Palestinians, we were saying for the first time, and this was our, like, as youth, this is what we felt. We are going to create the first real democracy. We are going to be the model for the rest of the Arab world. They're going to look at us and say, wow, if the Palestinians can live in a real democracy with freedom and elections, freedom of the press, and no violations of human rights and freedom of assembly, then we become the model for the rest of them. Well, very quickly we fell into their trap. We became like the rest of them. We had our token elections, but we had, of course, the results. I'm not going to say they were rigged, but the results were very clear. Only certain political parties won power. And these political parties had absolute power on us. We saw human rights violations. We saw a lot of corruption happening. A lot of funds were coming and continue to come to the Palestinian Authority. Where was this money going? Who knew? We saw people who came with absolutely nothing within a year have big mansions in Ramallah and Bethlehem. Where did that money come from? People were afraid of even asking these questions. And so all of these things that were happening in my mind said something is really, really wrong with this peace process. Something needs to happen. This whole thing will probably collapse. And so in 1998, a group of us came together and started this organization called Holy Land Trust. And our basic idea behind this, our slogan to say is our slogan is strengthening the communities for the future. If we want peace, if we want freedom, if we want real recognition of the rights of the peoples in this land, if we want real democracy in what we were told was going to be our state, it is the communities that decide this. The leaders can negotiate whatever agreement and treaty they want to negotiate because they have their own ideological and economic agendas that they want to achieve. At the end of the day, if the people don't have the full buy-in, are not fully invested, do not see the future benefits for them in that peace process, in that Palestinian state, they will reject it. And not just reject it, they might even fight it. And so for us, the question is, how can we empower the communities to decide their future, to be the determinant of making that real peace happen? As I always say, even as Palestinians, you know, certain areas were even negotiated by our Palestinian leadership. And these Palestinian leaders who were negotiating, or these negotiators who were negotiating, sometimes never stepped foot in the areas that they were negotiating. For us, one example in Bethlehem is Rachel's Tomb. Rachel's Tomb is a site that is holy for the three religions. And Rachel's Tomb exists in Bethlehem, in the area of Bethlehem. But Rachel's Tomb is not just Rachel's Tomb. It is houses, it's shops, it's a whole community that lived around Rachel's Tomb. And the Palestinian negotiators negotiated Rachel's Tomb, and the way they divided it between Israel and the Palestinian Authority in a way that most of the families that lived there suffered. Because they were looking at maps. They were not meeting with the people. They did not see the economic and social fabric of that community, what it looked like. These are the things that existed for us. We heard about negotiation results from the media, not from our leaders telling us what they negotiated and what they did not negotiate. Al Jazeera was our source to find out what happened in these negotiations. And so this is the reason why a group of us came together and said, we need to do something about it. By the 1998, we started the organization. 1999, the negotiations began to collapse. In the year 2000, they completely collapsed, and we went into what's known as the second intifada, the second uprising that began in October 2000. A time, unlike the first intifada, this time was marked by tremendous violence, and I would say by both sides towards each other. I'm not going to be the one here that's going to say they started it, and it's their fault why all this violence is happening, or they killed more of us than we killed of them, and they're not justified by their violence. And in my opinion, no violence should ever be justified, no matter what. Even violence of Palestinians, for me, is never justified against Israelis. And it was at this time that we said, we need to go back to the history of nonviolence that we as Palestinians engaged in, especially during the 80s, during the first intifada. And as an organization, we began to mobilize against the protests of many other Palestinian groups who felt that we tried nonviolence and we failed in it. We insisted that let us go back to nonviolence. And as I said, many Palestinian groups rejected us. But we insisted and continue to exist that nonviolence is the way to move forward. And we began to organize protests and demonstrations and different campaigns to promote nonviolent activism to end the occupation. And I'll probably say this several times, as I said it before, the idea that we had at that time, and many people still carry this idea, that the only peace that is possible, that can exist in the framework of our conflict, is the two-state solution based on the Oslo peace process. So in a sense, we became defenders and people who were resisting to achieve what the politicians failed to achieve in the negotiations. So our demonstrations and protests at that time were targeting the symbols and the structures of the occupation that is preventing us from having an independent state. And these included the checkpoints, the roadblocks, the fences, the settlements, and in beginning in 2003, the building of the separation walls and fences that now spread all across the West Bank. And so this was the target of our resistance, to try to dismantle these things and to bring them down. And very quickly, we became a leading organization in this work. We received a lot of attention for the work of nonviolence. And it wasn't just us. Again, working with many Palestinians and working with many Israelis in this field of direct nonviolent action. As we moved forward in this work, as I shared before, it felt like at some point I started asking different questions than just how do we organize the next demonstration? How do we do the next resistance? I started asking questions, for example, why did the peace process fail? Why did it really, really fail? Many people until this day, if you ask Palestinians why the peace process failed, what will they do? They'll blame Israelis. They'll say it's their fault why it failed. If you ask Israelis why the peace process failed, they'll say it's the Palestinian fault why it failed, and they'll try to make the argument. For me, I wanted to go much deeper, to really begin to ask, really, why did this peace process fail? Then there has to be more to it than just to blame the other for its failure. The Oslo peace process was probably the most invested in peace process in modern history. Billions of dollars was invested in the Oslo peace process. Negotiations at the top level were engaged in. Economic development, input, research, strategic, think tanks, everything was provided for the negotiators to create a solution, and we still failed. So there has to be much more than just to say the other side is to blame for it. And so that was one sort of questions that I was experiencing and living in. Another question I had is, maybe a naive question, is what is this conflict really about? We grew up, again, in a narrative that told us this conflict is about two nations fighting over the same piece of land, and both claim historic rights to this land. Is it just it? Is it, again, part of this narrative that says we are historic enemies and we have always hated each other? Well, what was the situation in certain neighborhoods, like my grandmother's neighborhood, where they actually got along with each other. Is it like, you know, genetic theology in us that we hate each other, or that there has to be more to it? What is really at the core of this conflict? I started asking these questions. And in this, also asking the question, what does real peace in the land look like? Was the Oslo peace process, or the framework of the two-state solution, as presented by Oslo, the only possible option for peace in this land? Or is there more to it? Can we be creative and think of alternatives? If this has failed, is there another thing? Or that's it, as we were told. If this fails, there will be nothing else possible for peace in this land. Well, this has failed. What other alternatives are there? And I began, in a sense, on this journey that for me is a political journey, for me it's a religious journey, it's a spiritual journey as well, to try to find out what this thing is really about and what can we do to really move forward in it. As I was engaging in these questions, I received an invitation, so it's about 10 years ago now, from Jewish American friends of mine who run an organization called the Peacemaker Circle International, Bernie Glassman and Eve Marvel. And Bernie and Eve invited me, who knew of our work, who had been supporting us, invited me to go with them on a retreat that they hold annually called the Bearing Witness Retreat. And this is a retreat that happens in the death camps of Auschwitz and Birkenau. Historically, they did this retreat to invite Germans and Jews to bear witness to the Holocaust, to come together and to heal the wounds, the collective wounds that they have caused each other. And I hadn't shared with them about what I was going through, and they said, "We feel that we would like for you to come and to be part of this retreat, to bear witness to the Holocaust." And initially, I say I hesitated as a Palestinian. It's not that I'm a Holocaust denier, and not actually many Palestinians are Holocaust deniers, but we don't deal with it. The Holocaust is not our issue. It's something that happened in the past. It's something that happened for the Jews and the Germans and the other Europeans, and they have to deal with it. Our struggle is our struggle. Our struggle is with Israel. It's not even we hear many Palestinians say it's not even a Jewish thing. It's Israel and Zionism that are oppressing us and occupying us. This is where our struggle is. Judaism, we don't have an issue with it. So whatever happened there, that's their issue. They have to deal with it. And it was very interesting, because the first time I actually wanted to go to this retreat, the Israeli military, the head of the Israeli military in the Bethlehem area, when he found out that I was going there, actually took me into interrogation and challenged me, asking me, "What is it that you want? Why are you going there? What's the point of you going? What do you want to achieve by going there?" And I just said, I just want to know. And so there was this sort of pushback from him. Why does a Palestinian want to go there? So there was kind of this rejection on both sides of us as Palestinians learning about the Holocaust or experiencing it. And I could understand, maybe he thought I had a different agenda. I don't know how he thought I maybe wanted to manipulate my experience there or take advantage of something there. So the first year I wasn't able to go. The second year I was able to go. And honestly, I share this as just my own personal process. In Auschwitz, for me, I say this, on a personal level, I discovered a key component of why we live in the conflict in the Holy Land, between Palestinians and Israelis. And that key component is fear. That key component is the trauma that was experienced by the Jewish community, not just, of course, in Auschwitz and the Holocaust, but decades and centuries leading up to it. The marginalization, the manipulation, the violence, if you don't know that history, you need to learn that history and know the history of Jewish suffering for centuries in Europe, the high point being the Holocaust and what happened there. And how, for me, what was clear was the lack of healing and the lack of closure in a very real way of that historic tragedy has affected how Jews today, especially in Israel, relate to us as Palestinians. And I'm not saying they're doing to us what happened to them. This is a sentence I completely reject, even though that some Palestinians might say that. For me, I say the lack of healing for the Jewish suffering, the historic wounds that they have carried, that lack of healing has resulted in them creating a situation where they simply cannot trust anybody ever again because of what happened to them. And I heard this being said in Auschwitz and Birkenau. I heard Israeli teachers tell Israeli children. I was there twice, each time for 10 days. And I heard numerous teachers tell Israeli children, in a sense, that the Holocaust is not over. The suffering of the Jewish people did not end with the end of the Holocaust and the establishment of the State of Israel. That as Jews, we will always be targeted, and using sentences like what's used in Passover, every generation a nation rises out to destroy us. These sentences were being told to every generation a nation will rise out to destroy us. And they were told, and I heard this by these teachers being said, that if the Arabs, if the Palestinians are given an opportunity, they're going to do to us what happened to our ancestors. So in a sense, they labeled the next generation that was going to commit an atrocity that could be even as big as the Holocaust itself. So for me, as a Palestinian, I wasn't just another Palestinian and another person who was fighting for liberation or independence. I was potentially the next SS soldier that can commit the greatest atrocity if that opportunity was given to me. And then for me, I spent a whole day crying at this. It shook me to my core. The experience of the past, to learn firsthand what happened to the Jewish people, and to see how that narrative is being told as a continuous story of Jewish existence, that the future will be a continuation of that experience. And this is why we have to be strong, this is why we have to protect ourselves, this is why we can never trust anybody, this is why joining the army is your personal responsibility to defend the nation. You are personally responsible for making sure that this doesn't happen to us again. And the army is the only way to do this. I came back from that experience completely shocked. And I met with my staff and I said, it's not that we got it wrong, but we are missing a key component of peacemaking that I felt was never presented in this conflict. And that component is, how do we heal the wounds and the traumas of our communities, both our communities? I began to realize at that point that both our communities, and I'm not trying to compare in any way the traumas that we have experienced, but both of our communities are suffering from what I call existential threat. We both are continuously afraid that our existence will cease to be if we don't do something about it. And for the Jewish people, they have a history to remind them of that. And for us as Palestinians, 1948 and the Nakba and what happened there is our burden that we carry. We lost our land and we are continuously losing our land. Our existence is on the line and we have to do something about it. And some people see violence as the way to do something about it. Some people see negotiations as the way to do something about it. And even at that time, I began to realize that one of the reasons why the Oslo peace process failed, and there are many, many reasons, and I'll mention maybe a couple of them later on. One reason why the Oslo peace process failed is because it was a process that was motivated by fear of the other. We were afraid of them because, again, our existence is being completely destroyed by them, like the narrative we grew up in, and therefore let us sign anything with them to be able to maintain our existence, even if we get very little from what is justly ours. The Palestinians do. On the Israeli side, let us negotiate with them, because if we don't negotiate with them, one day there's going to be more of them than us, and demographically that will shift the reality, and the possibility that they will commit the Holocaust towards us is real, because this is our narrative. So demographically, we need to maintain a majority. The only way to do this is to give them a piece of the land and let them establish their state on it. But even with that, we will maintain overall control, because security is above everything else. We will not allow this Palestinian state to really be fully free and independent. We will maintain control over the borders, we will maintain... Fear will still continue to motivate this. And I think this, for me, is one of the reasons why peace failed. You cannot achieve real peace if your motivation is fear of the other. If you don't go deep in a way where you begin to respect and honor the narrative of the other, if you don't have leaders that are ready to apologize for the atrocities that have been committed on both sides towards each other, and to acknowledge that we have done wrong to you, and we need to be able to move forward from this wrong, not to just create an illusion of it, but to really go deep into this process, in my opinion, you will never be able to achieve real peace. Another reason that also became apparent for us why the peace process failed, and this is something that we are doing now as an organization, is the following. We were told during Oslo that, and this is secular leaders on both sides telling us that religion is the problem. The reason we have this conflict is because of the religious fanatics that reject peace. And if we take religion out of the equation, then we will be able to resolve this problem again as a secular, even Western-style negotiation, between brackets American, and we will be able to reach the right solution, the right peace solution. And one of the things that we are beginning to realize more and more is that the marginalization of the religious voice was the problem itself. That these secular leaders were so afraid of the religious voices from their own community that they wanted to marginalize the religious voice because they were afraid that this religious voice might actually have power in any future peace or nation state building in both communities. And so I began to really ask the question, well, religiously, who is my enemy? And that led me to begin to talk with people. This is about 5 years ago, that honestly, if you gave me $1 million 5 years ago and said, talk to these people, I would say no. And these are the religious Orthodox, even some who are settlers in the land itself. Those people who were labeled as the worst of the worst of the enemy. Those people that I grew up in the narrative that told me that they are the enemies. If they did not exist, there will be peace. Just like on the other side, there are people that are told there that groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad are the enemy. If they exist, there will be peace. And if you buy into this narrative, there will always be somebody on the other side that if they did not exist, there will be peace. And so for me, I began to really engage in asking the question, well, who is my enemy? Who are the settlers? What is their story? What is their narrative? I know what I heard from media. I know what I heard from others. I know what I heard from seeing and witnessing some violence done by settlers towards Palestinians, but is this a representation of all of them? And to make it short, because of time, we have reached the point where we have now formed groups where Palestinians and settlers are actually coming together and talking about this. This is something that has been very challenging. And if I want to be honest, it has been challenging to many of my Israeli Tel Avivian lefty friends than even some Palestinians. Because again, in the narrative that the Israeli left has, is that those are the problem, let's get rid of them and there will be peace with Palestinians, because for them it's about, again, this framework of the two states. And it was very interesting for me to have these conversations with settlers and to hear their story. And I'm going to share one story with you. So, a meeting was arranged between me and a leading rabbi settler from the settlement of Beit El. Beit El is a settlement near the Palestinian city of Ramallah. It is so extreme that settlers cringe when they hear about Beit El. I mean, that's like how some fanatic they are. And so we decide that we're going to meet in a coffee shop in Jerusalem. And as a good Palestinian, I have no idea who this guy is. I didn't do any research. As a good Jew, he's done all the research on me. He's read all my blogs, seen all my films, done all the research about my history, everything I've ever done and involved in. He probably knew it more than I do because I forgot. And so I went early to this coffee shop, I'm sitting down, he comes straight at me and he sits right across the table from me. Very nice, he shakes my hand and he says, I want you to know, 1948 was a miracle, God returned us to this land, this is the promised land, and we are here. We have returned, after 2,000 years, we have returned to this land. I also want you to know, 1967 was the fulfillment and the completion of this miracle. The whole thing is ours, from the river to the sea. This is Jewish land. We have full autonomy over this land. This is the promise to us. Okay. Then he says, unlike you Christians who believe in this Messiah that came and ended the covenant between us and God and created a new covenant for his followers, we don't believe in your Messiah. And even if that Messiah did come, the covenant with the Jewish people is eternal and God never ever breaks his promise to the Jewish people. In my mind, I'm thinking, three strikes. I really have nothing to say to this guy. I don't even know why this meeting was set up. Another person has arranged this meeting. Then he says, but there's more to this. He says, as Jews, we need to understand and to really ask the question, what does it mean that we have now returned to this land? What does it mean to be a Jew that has gained and regained full autonomy over this land? Is it just about us coming back and protecting ourselves and protecting a group? Or is the covenant much more than this? And what happens to us when we break our part of the covenant? God brought us back. What is our part of the deal? And what happens if we break our part of the deal? And then he went into this amazing, beautiful discussion about who are the Jewish people? And what is the message of the Jewish people? If they are the chosen people and they have returned to this land, then what are they supposed to do with their return to this land? And he went, he said, the first point, we are to be a light to all nations. This is what we are called to do. And he said, as Jews, are we being a light to you? You are the closest nation to us. You Palestinians are the closest. If we are not able to be a light to you, how can we be a light to other nations? And he said, we are being darkness. He said, as Jews, we are also to be agents of justice and righteousness. How are we living justice and righteousness in our behavior towards you as Palestinians, as Arabs? The third thing he said, we are to treat the stranger as equal amongst us. That we should all live under one law. You live under Israeli military law, we live under our civil law. How is this helping us fulfill our covenant? As Jews, we are not to divide the land. We are now dividing this land. These secular leaders are dividing the land between us. How does this help us create peace in this land? How can this help us fulfill the covenant, the promise of God? And it was for the first time that I've heard this. And we hear, like, as Christians, the chosen people and light to all nations, but to hear a Jew, a religious Jew, go in a deep journey, and he's been on this journey of asking the question, what does it really mean for us now? And in a sense, so that we won't be kicked out from the land again, how can we fulfill our part of the deal? And for me, that created an amazing conversation that has continued. And now we are forming these groups where these Jews and Muslims and Christians are meeting each other. And in a sense, we are not discussing political solutions. We're discussing human solutions of how can we truly recognize our inherited rights in this land, in the whole land. I cannot deny a Jew who says 80% of my historic religious identity actually exists in Judea and Samaria. which is the West Bank, which these secular leaders were going to give us as Palestinians to establish this secular dictatorship of a state on it. And to say, but these Jews, if this is their history, if this is their indigenous roots, who am I to deny it? And at the same time, who is he to deny my indigenous roots as a Christian to this land, as a Palestinian to this land? Where when I looked at it, I saw, we'd become very good friends, and at one point I started joking with them. I said, well, 80% of your religious sites are in the West Bank, 80% of my religious sites are on the other side of the Green Line. As a Christian, yes, Bethlehem was where Jesus was born, but what did he do there? He ran away 2 years later. And so for me, yes, Jerusalem all the way to the Galilee is where my historic religious existence is, and I want to be able to have full access to that site as well. And he says, this is your right. The Green Line means absolutely nothing for Jews or for Arabs. It's culturally, geographically, politically, socially, religiously, has no significance to us. Now, immediately you might think, okay, Sam is presenting a one-state solution. This is not the point. What we are working on is this notion of what I would call equal rights as the foundation to establish the right political solution. It could be a two-state solution. It could be a three-state solution. If you don't know, there are actually 23 different solutions that are presented out there now. 23. And I would say none of them work if you don't have the foundation, the right foundation to establish the right political solution. And that foundation, as I said, is about recognizing the equal rights, the civil rights, the religious rights, the historic rights of all the communities in this land as the foundation. And then from there begin to ask, what is the future that we want to create? This is the work that we are doing now. So if you ask me what is the political solution, I will answer the first question, is I don't know. And at some level, I would say, I don't care. No political solution works now. The secular leaders can negotiate whatever they want. It will not lead to peace, because we are missing that foundation. Thank you for your listening and for being here tonight. Thank you. I know I may have run over time, but we can open up for questions.
Anybody got a quick one?
Well, I'll start with a question.
Thank you very much, first of all. It's been really interesting. And thank you for your description of your work with settlers. I thought that was particularly interesting and a new part of the story for me. I'm also interested on the other side about your work with Hamas, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we have been accused of as an organization is training Hamas. And many people want to ask, what did we train them in? We definitely did not train them in any militarized, violent way. Groups actually from Hamas approached us several years back, and they were very much interested in our nonviolent approach. And they asked us to do training with them, and it was at a time when Hamas had decided that they want to run for political office, to run in the elections. In a sense, running in the elections was we could call it a de facto recognition of the reality that we're living in. In a sense, a de facto recognition of Israel as a nation state, and they were running for political office within the Palestinian Authority. And many of you are aware of the elections that happened in 2006, that actually Hamas won in these elections and led to a mini civil war between Hamas and Fatah, where sadly, for the first time in many, many years, we saw Palestinians kill each other. And so there was this movement that was beginning to take place within Hamas, where I felt at that time, and this is why I said yes to train them, that they were really engaging in a deep internal discussion as to what is the future that they want to engage in. How do they want to move forward? And so they asked us to come and to do this training, and it was a very, I would say, life-transforming training for the people that took it with us. 20 young men took this training. It was in the north of the West Bank. It was an intensive training. It wasn't easy. But for us, it was presenting them with a nonviolence as an approach that for us as Palestinians was to achieve our goals. And at that time, as I said before, it was about ending the occupation and achieving two states. We would never in any way train anybody in any methodology that they would want to use to destroy the other, even if it's non-violence. And so for us, we made it very, very clear in terms of where we stand as an organization. Again, I said at that point it was the two-state solution, it was the Oslo peace process, and we will train you if you are ready to be engaged in non-violence to help achieve this. But, and this is the only engagement that we have had with them. The engagement that was then, the engagement now we are having with them, which is not in a direct way, but people who are affiliated maybe closely with Hamas, who would not say they are Hamas, is inviting them to these meetings with the settlers. And to really ask, as people who are devout Muslims, and we're not saying Hamas represents Islam in any way, but people who are conservative in their understanding of Islam, and people who are conservative in their understanding of Judaism, if we bring you together, you have been marginalized by the secular leadership. You have been put on the side. You have been labeled as the anti-peace. If you come together, can you come up with an alternative or not? And this is the challenge that we're putting in front of them. So we're not directly dealing with Hamas, but people who would maybe say they're sympathetic with groups like Hamas.
Anybody else want to?
In the seminar you had there, you spoke about the element of trust, which is essential between two antagonists, if you like, in a conflict situation. And you've also alluded here to the fact that on the Israeli side, there's this fear of the second Holocaust being visited upon them, and on the Palestinian side, a fear that they may have to re-experience 1948 all over again. One of the key reasons, in my view and the view of others, is that the Oslo Agreement failed. I mean, the Oslo Agreement had a lot of positive aspects to it, and there are a number of other reasons why it failed, as you just explained. But one of the key sticking points there is in the fact that in the Palestinian constitution, they have never removed the clause calling for the destruction of the state of Israel. I was wondering if you could clarify that for us, please.
I think you specifically refer to the Hamas charter where it hasn't been removed, but not in the Palestinian nor in the PLO. That has, as far as I know, and we could check this, but as far as the PLO is concerned, and Yasser Arafat and Fatah as a party, the statements, the charter, everything that they have signed was for the achievement of the two-state solution. For Hamas, I agree with you. They have not removed that from their charter. And they have actually said they will not remove that charter unless that was part of the negotiations, not a precondition to negotiations. But I think for the PLO and for the Palestinian charter in general, and again, we can check this because I haven't read it in many years and we don't even go by it. That has been removed, if not every statement made by Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, and every leader has made it very clear, every agreement that they have signed is the recognition of the right of Israel to exist as a nation state.
Thank you, Sami. A couple of questions. One is, various official religious leaders, it sounds like this dialogue is going on at a grassroots level. And as they buy in from, I'm thinking, for example, in the Christian community, particularly from the Christian community, what sort of support are you getting officially? And the other one is, the other second question is, Israel defining itself as a Jewish state. Many people see that as problematic. From what you say in those conversations, could it be advantageous?
Yeah. When we talk about the Christian population, within the Palestinian areas, so the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, the Christian population is now about 1%, just a little over 1% of the Palestinian population. So it's a very small population group. It's a minority within minority within minorities. And so while it has an important voice, many Christians are leaders in the community, the Palestinian community, and are providing everything from social services and political engagement. When we look at it population-wise, if the Muslims and the Jews come up with an agreement that they both feel honor them, then we feel also that the Christian community will automatically be part of that agreement, that that voice will not be neglected, because we feel that there is a respect for the Christian voice and the Christian heritage in the land itself. And so we are not at this time inviting Christian leaders to be part of this. We are really trying to focus, I want to be honest, even more, I would say, both Jews and Muslims have historically suffered so much on the hands of Christians. And until Christians really come up with a very strong apology to the Jewish community of what we have done to the Muslim community of what we have done to them, and ask for reconciliation for what we have done in terms of atrocities, then I think we should not even be invited as an equal in this part, on this table, or invited to show off our sort of Christian peacemaking as the right thing to do, because we have done bad things that we need to apologize for in our past as well. So now we're focusing on Jews and Muslims coming together. For me, it's been an honor as a Christian to be part of this conversation, to be invited, to be trusted in facilitating a lot of this work that is happening. And so for me, I see that, yes, there is an opening for that. When it comes to the second question, yes, politically speaking, it has been very, very challenging for Palestinians to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And then it's a lot of playing around with the words. So at some point, the Palestinian leadership will say that we recognize that Israel is a state for the Jewish people, but not a Jewish state. Where it means that in the sense that there is a recognition that the majority of people that live in Israel are Jews, and we cannot deny this, but it's not a Jewish state, because there are people that live in Israel who are not Jewish. There are Muslims and Christians that live there, so how can this be acknowledged? At the same time, many Palestinians say, well, why are we the only country in the world that is asked to have this recognition? Every country that has recognized Israel never had it in their mandate that they have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Even Jordan and Egypt, when they recognized Israel, they did not they recognized Israel as a state that exists with very clear borders and whatever systems they have. So no country has ever asked another country to recognize it because of what they religiously believe. Like if you recognize Saudi Arabia, you don't recognize Saudi Arabia as a Muslim state. They might be a Muslim state, but you don't recognize them as New Zealand, as a Muslim, you recognize them as a nation state among the many nation states in the world. And so this is where that big challenge is. This said, in this new conversation we are engaging in, one of the questions we are asking is, how can we recognize the entire country as a country for the Jewish people, and for the Muslim people, and for the Christian people, that they all have legitimate rights and claims in this land, that we all have deep roots in this land that are part of our faith traditions. And so in a sense, it does not deny actually Jewish recognition in the entire land. And this is where many of our settler friends are very happy, because they say, yes, Jews are recognized in Judea and Samaria as much as in any other country. And at the same time, how can we acknowledge and recognize the Muslim and the Christian claim to the land itself? And what we're saying, this might be saying, oh, if this is it, it's going to be a problem. Well, we're saying that this is the honest truth, that, you know, in the heart of the people that live there, they see the whole thing as theirs. If we really, really want to be honest with each other. Most people on both sides, they had to swallow the bitter pill of the two-state solution. It was imposed on us. As Palestinians and Israelis, if we want to be really truthful with each other, the Palestinians feel the whole thing is theirs, and the Israelis feel the whole thing is theirs. And instead of this being the point of contention and conflict, we're saying this honest truth can be the point of real negotiations, of moving really forward and trying to say, okay, now that we have this issue clear, how can we move forward in peace with it? Instead of playing these games about cutting it and dividing it.
Thank you. As a member of the Jewish community, I was a bit concerned about the historical narrative that you gave. You started by saying you were not going to use 1948 as a starting point, and that your open lines are now before 1948. But what worried me was your strong reference to Jewish fear arising from the Holocaust. And that seems to me to be drawing another line, which is earlier, a few years earlier, say 1939 or 1945, whereas this year in particular, we remember the centenary, the 100 years of quite major political events that affected the Holy Land, such as the Balfour Declaration, the conquering by the British of the Holy Land, taking it from the Ottoman Empire. And the historical events that followed were in terms of those days also violent and oppositional. In 1920 there were riots, in 1929 there was violence, in 1936 there was what is called by the British anyway the Arab Revolt. I'm not sure what the Palestinian term is for it. And in spite of attempts to resolve the conflict at that time, nothing actually happened. And as you said, the two-state solution was even attempted to be imposed through the Peel Commission of 1937, which said we will give this amount of territory and so on. So it worries me that your emphasis is very much, it seemed to me, on the experience, the Jewish experiences of the Holocaust, when in fact, historical fact, the conflict actually started much earlier, and I think in the terms of, in the eyes of Israeli Jews, has got a longer history, a pre-Holocaust history.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, for me, when I talk about the Holocaust, I really share it from a very personal experience. I said, this is where I began to recognize and acknowledge and to see for the first time Jewish suffering in a way that I had not seen and experienced before. There is always in the narratives that we learn, especially in the conflicts that happened before 1948, including the Hebron massacre in the 1920s that you referred to, there is always narratives to try to justify what happened. There are stories from both sides to try to justify who started it, what started it. The Palestinians refer to Balfour Declaration as the start of the conflict. Before the Balfour Declaration, we lived in peace with each other much more than after the Balfour Declaration. So the British are to blame for creating this whole mess to start with. Many people look into that massacre in Hebron and say it was instigated by what was happening outside of the land, not what was happening inside the land. So we create, we kind of dehumanize those who suffer from it and put it in the context of historic conflict and war. And as I said, it wasn't utopian. It wasn't perfect. There were conflicts between the two sides or the three sides that existed. before 1948. And I refer to just the real example of where my father was born and grew up in that neighborhood, where they did not experience those conflicts. And we could talk about the Muslims in Hebron, the families that defended the Jews, that put them into their homes, so we could create that story. But for me, being in Auschwitz and Birkenau touched me in a deep way that I had never been touched by an experience of another nation suffering as what happened there. When I saw, I don't know if you've been there, if any of you have been there, but it's not a Holocaust museum, it's the real thing. It's like really what happened there. To see the lakes where the remains of Jews were poured into, and like to be standing right there. To see the railroad track in Birkenau where people came in and were dumped off the trains, and some people went straight into the gas chambers, some went to the workforce. To see the rooms that have the toys of the Jewish children that they carried with them that were dumped in one area, the clothes, the hair, the teeth, the gold teeth that were taken out. And, like, every experience there shook me to my core. And I say this really as a personal level, where for the first time I saw not just war and conflict, but the traumatized community. And as I said, it's not just the Holocaust, it's centuries of experiences that the Jewish people faced. I began to study Jewish history after that experience. I began to research and to learn and to see what is that story that I was not told, to be honest, as a Palestinian. We don't learn about the Holocaust in our textbooks, in our schools. We don't hear the story of the other. And so for me, as I said, it was a personal transforming moment that opened my eye to begin to see the other differently than just the enemy and judge them just by how they acted towards them. There is a story that I never knew before that. And so in no way do I undermine or negate any of the other, of the entire history of Jewish suffering. But again, on a personal level, this is what was the trigger for me.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question.
Was there one more? Okay.
My question is around the problem of the future. And I don't know if you can do that too much, but maybe you can give some idea of what your hopes are or what your realistic thoughts are about what might happen.
That's two questions. What really might happen and what my hope is. I'm worried about the future, to be honest. I don't want to present anything I said as, you know, a flowery peace process that we are beginning. The future is very gloomy. And the way things stand now is that what is happening is that there is more hatred and resentment and fear and mistrust, to use that word, more than any other time. As a Palestinian, I am getting attacked by other Palestinian organizations for the work that I do. And I'm not talking like extreme groups. These are kind of moderate groups that are calling me, the term that's used now is normalizing. If you've heard this term before, normalization is sort of the new accusation that Palestinians who engage in any war with Israelis are accused of. On the Israeli side, those who are engaging in peace work or justice work or rights of the Palestinians are seen as the absolute traitors by other Israelis. They're not just, you know, crazy lefties who are doing this work. They are traitors to Judaism. They are traitors to Israel. They're traitors to Zionism. And they are suffering. And many Israelis have left the land because they are fearing for their own lives, not from Palestinians, but from other Israelis that might threaten them. And so, yes, at the level of the reality, it's very, very difficult. And for me, when people ask me, well, why do you do all this work internationally and go around and travel? Because I believe that even what's happening there, even though New Zealand might not be affected by it, but the rest of the world is deeply affected by it. Especially when it comes to these three religious groups and how they relate to each other. Christians, Muslims, and Jews in the world use what's happening in the land as a reference in how they relate and treat each other. And not just that, Many Jews use the land as a reference in how they relate to each other. Many Christians use the land also in reference in how they relate to each other. I know Christian pastors who do not talk with each other on issues that are very important in their community, in their city, that they need to work together. And the reason they don't talk to each other is because they don't agree on our situation. Okay? So they can work together and help poverty in their land, help children in their cities, but they refuse to because of us. And the same within the Jewish community, and the same, maybe not to an extent with the Muslim community. But when it comes to the three religions, yes. And so for me, I'm really seeing that we are moving in a phase where if we don't do something about it, it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And who knows what that ultimate worse looks like. And this is what's pushing me to say we need to break the old paradigms. We need to create new paradigms of getting people together, understanding each other, speaking with each other, learning who they are, and building a future vision together. And so yes, I do have hope. If I didn't have hope, I wouldn't be doing the work I'm doing. And my hope actually exists in something so creative that will happen in this land that even in my current mind, I cannot even comprehend. It will be beyond what we all think is peace in this land. And that's where my hope lies.